Welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. I'm Alan Wilson, the host of the podcast, and each week the podcast aims to give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey. Last week we began talking to Dr. Derek Tidball. Derek is an author. He has served as a Baptist minister. He has been principal of London School of Theology. His most recent book is a book called Lead Like Joshua. Obviously, it's a book on leadership. We talked a little bit about that book last week. As we talked about some of the early stages of Derek's leadership and some of the influencers on his life. So welcome back, Derek, as we pick up your story. We've been talking here about just some of the early stages of your development as a leader. We finished up last week talking a little bit about some of the unknown people, the small people, not the people whose names are in lights, who had been major influences. In terms of the timeline of your story, I think we got you just about getting into Baptist ministry. A couple of churches that you were involved with before you really moved into more of a calling into theological education. Tell us a little bit about those churches.
Yes, not exactly, but more or less. I became pastor of a small Baptist church about 20 miles from London Bible College. I was the first full-time pastor, at least in living memory. They were a small, what used to be a village church attached to a slightly larger town, and they had grown just sufficiently. They were on paper about 50 members, in reality more like 35 members, to be able to afford a full-time pastor. And I spent a great 5 years there. I'm so thankful to them. There were three or four couples, younger couples, amongst that group who could have gone off to more prosperous churches nearby. We had a number of well-known churches within spitting distance of ours, but they invested themselves deeply in North Church. And by the grace of God, we saw that church grow so that after 5 years, it was firmly on its feet and in a different position. We baptized a number, mostly of young people at that stage, and saw a number of conversions. I keep a list of those I baptized and look at through them every now and again. I wish I could say I prayed regularly for them all, but I don't. But it's encouraging to see a number of names on that list who've gone, whom I know are still going on serving Christ. And a high proportion of them, not everyone, because the parable of the sower alone teaches us that not everybody is going to do that. But while I was there, Gilbert Kirby asked me if I would also spend a little time at London Bible College. So I was spending a day a week teaching at London Bible College. After 5 years, it became impossible to hold both together. That's the trouble with two part-time jobs, isn't it? although ministry was meant to be full-time, and it was. But after 5 years, the opportunity opened up for me to become Director of Studies at London Bible College when the long-standing Clement Connell had retired. So I served, I think it was 8 years, as Director of Studies at the college. I completed my doctorate at that time. I began to teach more widely, got great experience of educational machinery. As a result of that, we were inevitably seeking accreditation through the Council for National Academic Awards and the last cycle of degree renewals that I had to go through. And that was a great apprenticeship. But after a number of years, I was very happy there. There was no reason to move. In some ways, it was academic suicide. If I'd wanted to be a known academic, then that was the time to stay and publish books that only three other people would ever read, because they were so obscure. You know, I just published a book on the sociology of the New Testament, which got some pretty good reviews, and I could have developed that, but I wasn't interested in doing that. My calling was really to bridge the academy and the church. So after 8 years, it was a question of whether I could do the job, which I was involved in training others to do. So he received a call to go to Plymouth as pastor of Mutley Baptist Church. Our initial response, I was married by this time, our initial response was far too far west. No, we wouldn't go down there, but God clearly opened the door, and we had a very significant 6 years there. And my intention was to bury myself in Plymouth, which is the back of beyond in English terms. There's only Cornwall to go after Plymouth. And
I'll not mention any Irish.
From Devon, we won't go there.
Okay, well, I'll not mention any Irish equivalents in case I offend somebody, as you've you've probably offended
exactly.
anybody from Cornwall.
My intention was that was going to be it from then on. We were very content. We weren't expected to have any wider ministry, etc. But God opened up all sorts of doors, and I ended up with a much wider ministry, becoming president of the denomination at that stage. And after 6 years, somewhat prematurely, if I've one regret, I probably left Plymouth too early, but the denomination asked me if I would become the secretary for mission. Mm-hmm. They had a real need and had been trying to appoint someone for a little time. David Coffey, who had been doing the job, had just become general secretary, mm-hmm. so it was a great joy to work with David, who was a friend. Nonetheless, I think, God had blessed us in Plymouth in many ways. We were seeing about 30 people being baptized every year, mostly with virgin faith, ripe fruit for the picking at that time. A church that needed to be in transition and was in transition. So I'm very grateful to the time spent there. And perhaps, if I altered one thing, I perhaps have stayed there longer. But God was in control, and God knows. And good things arose we wouldn't have anticipated otherwise. So.
Did Ian Coffey succeed you immediately?
Ian succeeded me, which I rejoice in. And Ian and I remain very good friends, of course. The great thing is Ian took the church forward. My reflection is they probably would never have invited Ian when they invited me.
Okay.
Because Ian would have been seen as too radical.
Okay.
I have, not as a matter of strategy, but it's just me. I have projected always a conservative image. Mm-hmm. Certainly at that time, I never wore a dog collar. My predecessor wore a dog collar and gowned every Sunday. I'd never do that. But I'd always wear a business suit and a collar and tie. Mm-hmm. I was the Reverend Doctor, etc. Mm-hmm. I'd begun to publish some fairly conservative books because theologically that's where I stand. Mm-hmm. So those who were cautious about too much radical change felt they were in safe hands. Mm-hmm. What they didn't quite realise was the radical heart that was under that conservative coat and collar and tie. So we were able to move the church culturally and spiritually in a way that was appropriate to that time in the late 80s. And they're keen on inviting Ian, who was able to build on that legacy. I think one of the things I reflect on, by the way, is that I followed a long ministry with a relatively short ministry. Ian then had a longer ministry, followed by a relatively short ministry. And I think sometimes after a long ministry, you just need a shorter ministry that will plough up some of the fallow ground and prepare them for a new age.
Yeah.
And I suspect that was part of my role in Plymouth.
It's interesting. We maybe shouldn't get, and it would be an interesting track to pursue. But we probably need to just stay on track with your story.
Sure.
Just with lots of things we could file away for to be discussed at a future time. Maybe I'll get Ian on the podcast because obviously after he left Mutley, he and I overlapped a little bit in the Geneva area.
Of course, in Geneva.
Yeah. So maybe I'll get Ian in the podcast, and he and I will kick this around, and we'll get your views on it. But you obviously ended up eventually back at London Bible College, which then became London School of Theology. How did that open up?
Well, it was reasonably plain to most people that I'd probably end up back in theological education in some way or another. The job of the principal of a theological college is very varied, and you need a number of skills. You're really a GP, you're a general practitioner, rather than anything else. People who are academic scholars are not often the ideal people for running at least larger Bible colleges, because you need management skills. You need a public relations skill, and you need broader personal skills. But you also need academic equipment, which gives confidence to your colleagues who are the academic scholars. And my track record by then was that I had published academically. As we said earlier, I never set out to be an academic person, but I had always sought to have scholarly credibility, and I think I was able to do that, so I was published in a number of areas. I had the educational background of director of studies. I had clearly some management skills, as was evident from previous occupations. My colleagues, I think, could respect me. In fact, my ex-colleagues were the ones who were keen on my going back when the vacancy occurred at the London Bible College to be principal there. So it was one of the things. I guess I get bored fairly easily, if the truth is known. If I was just an expert scholar on Colossians, who knew everything about Colossians but nothing else, I would probably be pretty bored. So I'm happy keeping a number of balls in the air at once and juggling with things, and moving from reading balance sheets to preaching in chapel to writing academic books and so on. And that's purely a gift that God has given. It's not me, but it's a gift that's not very common. So there aren't too many of us around. Can offer that sort of combination.
Yeah, and it's not just I don't think it's just a question of boredom, because I think it's also a question of being able to have expertise or a skill set that is broader than just one narrow area. I think how many years were you there then as principal?
I was then there as principal 12, 13 years. Okay. So that was a good stint.
Talking to maybe a bit more generally, not so much about timelines, but as you look at your leadership journey, what have been some of the challenges? And obviously there are leaders undergo personal challenges. There are also challenges that are directly related to their leadership. It's difficult sometimes to separate between those two categories. But what have been some of the challenges that you've had to face as you've gone through this leadership journey?
Some of them appear quite trivial, others of them are major. The one of my early lessons in leadership was I actually had the privilege of being chairman of British Youth for Christ in my early 20s, and we laid on a major national event in London, which we had committed to a subcommittee to run, and truth to tell, wasn't totally disastrous, but it was fairly disastrous. It didn't achieve any of the goals that we wanted it to. And from that experience very early on, I was learning about the importance of delegation, and that delegation is not abdication. That actually I had not built in, my colleague, the national director, hadn't built in accountability structures as we should have done. We trusted people too gullibly. So it's not a question that you mistrust people, but I was learning the importance of teamwork and of a right relationship and trust, and the importance of accountability in delegation. So there were lots of little things along the line. The the next important thing, I think, is probably learning to handle yourself, not always successfully by any means. Any leader is likely to be a driven person, and I certainly am and was. But drivenness has its downsides completely, and it's not always the best skill for leading others. You can actually alienate others and wind people up if you're not careful. And you can certainly harm yourself in the process, as I've done over the years. So learning to handle drivenness and to mature it and moderate it and filter it so that it's beneficial to others and not harmful to yourself is quite important.
Can you say a bit about how you've learned that?
Yeah, well, the biblical quality is the quality of meekness that I love. I'm always amazed when Moses is described in Numbers as the meekest person on all the earth, how he could deliver the children of Israel and get them out of Egypt and get them near the promised land. What a rabble. And it's clear that he was frustrated with them from time to time, as you would well know from your teaching of Moses. And yet he's described as meek. Meekness is that wonderful Greek word for that's used to describe a horse being broken in. So that when you break in a horse, it still has all the horsepower at its disposal, but its horsepower now, which is channeled and directed constructively rather than just throwing its weight all over the place and knocking over people and unable to be ridden on and so on. So the quality, I think, is to aim for meekness and to pray for God to bring meekness into your life, which you do sometimes by hard experiences when people tell you that that wasn't so helpful, and by learning to bite your tongue at times rather than just blast out with things as you might want to do inwardly. Always asking, as the leader must, not what is in this for me, but how can I best serve others? And I've learned through lots of failures in that area. The drivenness goes, as is well known in business studies, let alone in Christian studies, with a tendency to depression if you're not careful. Because you're always wanting to achieve, and because you're often measuring yourself by your achievement, which is the false way of doing it. When you don't achieve, or when you haven't observed certain rules and regulations, just in terms of rest and recreation, then you can certainly find yourself depressed if you're not careful. That's not always. Depression is a very widespread phenomenon caused in a number of different ways. I've had a number of patches of depression over the years, and sometimes it was circumstantial beyond my control. And the old definition of depression as anger, which is turned inwards, was very helpful at those those times. Wasn't able to do anything about the situation. Working in a Christian organization, you can't hit out, or you know, there are certain expectations of saintliness, whether they're realistic or not. So what you do is turn it inwards, and then it takes that internal toll. Just exhaustion and tiredness at the end. I should have left London School of Theology probably a year before I did. So I wasn't in a good place when I did leave, and nobody's fault but my own. Here you are relentlessly doing the same thing. I had a fairly demanding year that last year where nothing quite seemed to be working out right. It was subsequently discovered that I suffered from sleep apnea, so I was actually waking up exhausted every morning. That wasn't discovered for a couple of years after I left. If it had been discovered beforehand, then maybe we'd have been in a different position. But taking care of yourself you know, in all those ways are vital, and learning to manage it. So I'm much better now, though my wife may think otherwise, walking away from things and putting things down rather than just driving yourself forward all the time.
Yeah, is there an element with drivenness? Do you think it goes along? And I'm interviewing you. I'm not your psychologist, but is there an element of perfectionism that's associated with drivenness? To be driven to do something at a certain level?
A lot of people would accuse me of that and think so, but I distinguish between high standards and perfectionism.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would argue that I'm not a perfectionist.
Yeah.
I know that it is impossible to achieve perfection this side of life. So I do have high standards, and I am disappointed when they are not reached. But I wouldn't say that I was a perfectionist. I've got a couple of friends who are perfectionists who are really paralyzed by it. That's maybe only a matter of degree. But the perfectionist in my book actually is often unable to deliver because he fears, or she fears, that what they might deliver is not going to be good enough. I'm quite content to deliver as good as I can.
Yeah.
But then be disappointed when it wasn't quite as good as I hoped it would be. The other thing is that people think I'm a workaholic, and I suppose over the years the level of production has been quite high. And so I can see where that impression comes from. But again, I think I might distinguish between being a workaholic and believing in hard work.
Yeah.
And perhaps I blame the old Christian psychologist James White in his writings about this, but he argues that hard work is a good thing, not a bad thing, and it often leads out of depression rather than contributes to it.
How would you, I mean, if you're speaking to a younger leader who maybe has tendencies both to drivenness and to workaholism, how would you help them to distinguish between perfectionism and having high standards, and between workaholism and being a hard worker? Where are the lines? Where are the markers that you're crossing a line?
Well, the perfectionism, I think, is easier in that, as I said, the move from high standards to perfectionism is often a question of moving over the line whereby you don't produce things because you fear.
Yeah.
It won't be good enough. And there may well be a number of evidences of that. The failure to complete tasks, to complete even writing projects, or just organisational goals. The very negative reaction once you've done something, the insecurity that generates that means you just wish you hadn't done that because it wasn't good enough. And it's a fine line between that and just having the ability to stand back and be self-reflective and self-critical as you need to be. Reviewing things has always been extremely helpful. So at the church, when I was in pastoral ministry, the team in Plymouth would always get together, I think, for lunch on Tuesday or Wednesday, I can't remember, and we'd review the previous Sunday, what went well, what didn't go well, what could we have done differently, any major event, Christmas activities or whatever. Learn from the past. The perfectionist may well just get too discouraged to do that and go within themselves. Hard work versus workaholic is when you really can't let your work go, when you can't walk away from it at all.
Yeah.
And when it really takes over completely. And in my experience, because when you're driving yourself like that, you're often lacking creativity.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to do something in your tiredness that actually it would be much better if you walked away from it and just came back to it freshly. Things would crack open much more easily. So just reviewing with them a number of situations and incidents might be helpful.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful. I dare say for some listening to this, the challenge is not necessarily identifying it, but it's knowing how to get out of it if they've fallen in there.
Yeah.
And I suppose, you know, maybe they've got to, give themselves permission not to be perfect.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the hardest lessons. I've spent time with a number of younger leaders recently who I identify with them fully. You know, when you begin in Christian leadership, you think you are going to be perfect and you'll crack all the problems that nobody else has cracked up to now, and you won't make the mistakes that others make, and you won't have the limitations that others suffer from. And then you discover actually you're as fallen a human being and you're as limited a human being as anybody else is. And that's a very important biblical principle to learn, isn't it? That actually God uses not the perfect and not the strong, but the weak and the people who are failures and who are broken. So there's hardly a biblical leader who isn't broken in some way. And just going back to Joshua briefly, one of the most significant incidents is that in Joshua 5, where he encounters the captain of the Lord's army and has to surrender his own position and status to one who is greater. I can imagine if I had been in his sandals that night, I'd be saying, "What do you mean you're the captain of the Lord's army? That's me. I've got the calling. I've got the track record. I've served the apprentice for so many years under Moses. Get out of my way." But actually learning to surrender is crucial.
Yeah, I think learning to surrender to God, but I think also the horizontal element of that, and it strikes me, you know, now that I'm older and I can look back at my own leadership, that thing of the more you give away the power that you think you have as a leader, the more power you actually have.
That leads me to say something about power, because I would say that it's only in very recent years I've learned of the significance of power. I suppose it's come to the fore recently in secular events. It's come to the fore of thinking about leadership very much more. I would have said as a pastor, as a lecturer in a Bible college, I didn't really have any power. But then I discover the significance that power is transactional. It's what other people attribute to you, whether you think you've got it or not. And I've learned some hard lessons when I thought I was just being a nice brother in Christ, where actually other people thought I was abusing power. Because I hadn't taken into account title, position, whatever it was. So one of the things I'd be very concerned about now would be to help people to look at the dimension of power in leadership. We all say we haven't got it, but the reality is we have. It takes different forms. It may be the power of a charismatic leader who works miracles or offers prophecies that can be very dramatic. But the good old-fashioned Bible expositor like me equally has power. If I'm not in a position in a church, I have the power of opening up God's word. And that can sometimes be, I have sometimes been horrified by, dare I put it like this in one sense, how seriously people have taken or applied my words. And you just realize what power you have and how careful we have to be. So it's a very sensitive issue in today's world in terms of the abuse of power.
Yes, I think so. I had a leader say to me once, he reacted quite strongly to the idea that leadership was about power. He said, no, leadership is not about power. It's a conversation I need to have with him at some point in the future. The particular setting wasn't a place that allowed for adequate debate on it. But I do think it's there, whether it's authority, whether it's influence, they're all interconnected. And I think, I mean, as we realise, some of the most basic definitions of leadership are influence, and influence is a form of power. But it has to be handled very, very carefully. And I think, you know, go back to your example of Joshua. He needed to know, as we all do, who the ultimate source of power and authority is. Yeah. Just in the last couple of minutes, Derek, from the vantage point that you have, particularly in British evangelicalism, but also with a view in the wider church, because I know you still travel, what do you see as maybe the top couple of challenges for Christian leaders in 2018?
Some people will moan or groan at the use of the word balance, but I actually do believe in balance, and balance in this sense, that we need excellent Christian leaders on the one hand, and many of our churches are suffering from very amateurish leadership. Fall into all the traps that we've talked about from my own experience and more, who are very often, in fact, directionless or not driven and are not exercising leadership. There is a clear connection, empirically, between churches that grow and churches that are well led. So we desperately need a better quality of leaders, and not all of our colleges are helping in terms of the preparation of that. So that's on the one hand, but we also need leaders who are actually faithful to Scripture and know that with confidence what the gospel is and how to teach it. And the reason I argue for balance is it's very easy to have people who are gifted leaders who would grow an organization anyway, whatever it was, but actually are very superficial or even heretical in what they're saying in their leadership. On the other hand, we've got a whole cadre of very faithful biblical teachers and scholars who don't have a leadership boat in their bodies. And just a marrying of those two is vital. And that goes, I think, right across the board. So in terms of communication, we've got, on the one hand, a great set of communicators with nothing to communicate. On the other hand, we've got a great bunch of people who know what they want to communicate but haven't a clue how to do so. So unapologetically, I'd say we need people who are able to marry the diverse skills, leadership with biblical faithfulness, which you can break down in all sorts of other ways. Leadership is going to mean cultural sensitivity. It is going to be connectedness to this world. Biblical faithfulness is going to be about holiness and about distinctive lifestyle. And great communicators who are not boring in what they're saying, but on the other hand, know the Scripture. People who know the Scripture who can actually communicate it well.
That's great. That's great. Listen, that's great. A good note to end on. An appeal for leaders who are both in terms of those things. Derek, thank you so much for your time over these past couple
You're
of
welcome.
Weeks. It's been great to have you share with us. Appreciate it. And wishing you every blessing in what you continue to do as you keep on serving the Lord. Thank you.
Thank you, Al. Bless you.
Well, indeed, thanks to Derek for giving us the time over these past couple of weeks to talk about his leadership journey and some of his thoughts on leadership. Just a reminder about his book, Lead Like Joshua. Excellent book. It's got just over 20 short chapters. It's not that the shortness of the chapters makes them excellent, but it means it's a very easily digestible book. Each chapter is given over to a leadership lesson that's rooted in the story of Joshua. Also, a reminder that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and that next week we'll be back, all being well, and the guest next week will be Nigel Hamilton from Belfast, Sir Nigel Hamilton, actually, to give him his full title. Nigel is a Christian who has been very involved in public life in Belfast. In fact, went in his career to be the head of the civil service in Northern Ireland. So Nigel's going to be talking about his leadership journey over the next couple of weeks. So we look forward to talking to you then. Thanks for listening. Bye.